How can we meet the Paris Climate Accords through environmental credit solutions? Bill Flutterback is the president and CEO of Climeco and is a respected leader in the global environmental commodities market. Bill has created scalable greenhouse gas reduction efforts while creating a work culture at Climeco that nurtures creativity and empowers his team to embrace an entrepreneurial spirit. Today, Climeco operates at the forefront of an exciting transformation as global businesses, governments, and environmental advocates recognize that market-based solutions are the most efficient way to address environmental challenges. Bill Flutterback, welcome to Business and Society, a One Planet podcast.
Thank you, Mia. Really pleasure to be here with you and Bruce.
Hello, Bill. We're delighted here in New York and Paris to see you today.
So you're president and CEO of Climeco, which for those who don't know, is a pioneering force in the global environmental commodities market. Under your leadership, Climeco has not only spearheaded scalable greenhouse gas reduction efforts, but also fostered a workplace culture that champions creativity, of course, the transparency of climate innovation, and works to empower entrepreneurial spirit. Climeco, I understand, has been recognized for its technical expertise in environmental credits and commitment to ESG solutions, and really at the forefront of leveraging market-based strategies for a sustainable future. Can you start by just explaining how environmental credits work and why they're an effective tool for reducing greenhouse gas emissions?
Yeah, absolutely, Mia. You'll hear Climeco speak a lot about market-based solutions because oftentimes to really drive change in the market, when a company is looking at ways to decarbonize, the first thing that they're going to do is look within their own operations, typically. You know, how can they get decarbonized? What's the cost of decarbonization? We call it the marginal abatement. You know, can they decarbonize? Do the technologies exist? Oftentimes, those technologies exist outside of their operations. And the real benefit of the environmental markets allows companies to invest in projects that have a marginal cost. They have technologies, they have a reasonable marginal cost, they have technologies that are available. We can implement those projects at a facility, reduce those emissions with our partner's capital or with our capital, and then transfer the environmental attributes or the carbon credits to the investor. So what this really means is, so there's no double counting. So in order to create change today, we need to look at incentives to abate greenhouse gases at facilities. They're not taking the claim for those reductions, however. So they're getting the technology, they're getting the investment, they're making the reductions, but they're not counting them towards their quantifiable goals. They're transferring that right to the investor so they can count them towards their own goals. And that's how free markets work, is looking at companies that want to reduce emissions, they have the capital, and then identifying sites that have the potential for reductions, making those reductions, but then transferring those reduction rights or the credits to the investor outside.
That's really interesting. Could you break that info down for our audience who are looking at things from the outside in?
So oftentimes with Climeco, we talk about market-based solutions, and we believe in real reductions now. So as a global leader, there's two ways that we look at reductions: avoiding the molecule before it goes into the atmosphere, technology-based, or sequestering the carbon once it's already in the atmosphere. That can be achieved with nature-based solutions. So one way to think about carbon credits, many clients that are part of the Science-Based Target Initiative, for instance, have goals for reductions, but they also, in order to achieve net zero, they preferentially look at carbon sequestration projects or nature-based solutions. So that's an area where we focus on, where we will do massive scale plantings. We have a 14,000 acre planting in Louisiana currently, where we're doing the planting, we're sequestering the carbon, but then there's an investor that's purchasing the carbon credits to align with their own goals.
That's really interesting. It just helps us put that into context. And of course, disruption never sleeps. It's happening all the time. And now we have in America, disruptor in chief bent on putting polluters' profits ahead of people's lives and the environment in all. I'm just wondering how this affects you, Climeco, and us all globally. The EPA has issued 31 announcements that take aim at almost every major environmental rule designed to protect America's clean air and water, as well as a livable climate. So how has that disrupted Climeco's model, and how do you work with that?
That's a great question, Mia. I think we saw some disruptions 8 years ago as well, when the U.S. extracted from the Paris Agreement. So we took ourselves away from having a seat at the global table on climate change. Now, fast forward 8 years later, we're seeing it again, but we're seeing it in a more robust fashion. You mentioned a lot of the EPA reversals surrounding some fundamental regulations. Where we're resilient, Mia, which is why it's really exciting, is that A lot of our markets are based on voluntary commitments. What we saw 8 years ago is leaders in industry, they stepped up under the Trump administration. When the Trump administration said, we don't believe in climate change and we want out of the Paris Agreement, we saw Fortune 100 leaders step up and say, well, we do believe it's the right thing for our business and we're going to march forward with our commitments. Fast forward 8 years later, we're seeing the same thing already. It's early, right? We're not even 60 days in. But what we're seeing is we're seeing a reaction by leaders saying it does matter for us. You know, our carbon intensity of our products does matter. It differentiates us globally. And we have a 2030 commitment. There's a lot of commitments that are based on 2030 and then 2050. But companies know that in order to achieve their 2030 commitments, they can't take their foot off the gas for the next 4 years. Fast forward, that leaves them a very minimal amount of time to achieve their objective. So we are seeing action now. And what I get excited about is that the voluntary mechanisms that we have, they transcend compliance. They transcend EPA. What we're doing isn't based on an EPA regulation. So whether or not EPA reverses the endangerment findings stating that greenhouse gases are not an endangerment for the environment. In many ways, that's an incredible shame. That would be a huge step back, but we're not relying on EPA regulation. Most of what we do is really based on voluntary market, which I believe transcends a lot of the noise that happens because we're seeing a lot of noise over the last several years.
Yes, a circular economy in action, free of regulation. And I think it's a smart thing ClimeCo is doing in tandem with a voluntary-based market, you know, showcasing innovators in carbon capture, renewable energy and emissions reduction, a kind of collective creative, all moving towards a sustainable and livable future. So effectively, a key part of ClimeCo involves forging trusted partnerships to bring the right change makers together and advancing renewable energy projects.
Yeah, I love Bill's motto in life about to make a difference each day and always do the next right thing. I think you're saying that about voluntary markets, about technical innovation. So Bill, I want the listener to hear about what you're doing in Colombia's cloud forest, because that also explains how you're global already. How, you know, you look at the map of what ClimeCo does and you have activities in North America, Latin America, Africa, and budding places in Asia. If you could give people a sense of the scope of your firm, how you're a pioneer in the world, but you're also, maybe the Colombia cloud forest might be an interesting example. Or the Houston Food Bank, they're both telling examples of how you can advance climate control and innovation space by doing many interesting things with technology and people and other partners.
Yeah, that's a great question. And Bruce had stated about one of my key statements in life, do the next right thing. One of my mentors in life always would tell me, Bill, do the next right thing and don't tell anybody about it. And he said that for a reason. Do something nice every day, but don't tell everybody about it. We see a lot of organizations doing something because they want the press. One of the things that I've had to work with my marketing department on is they've always told me, Bill, we're doing a lot of great things, but we do want to tell some people about it because by telling people about it, it can inspire more action. But I also call it the 60-minute test. My father taught me, whatever you're doing in life, act as if you're on 60 minutes every day and ask yourself, is this something that you would be proud of being on 60 minutes? And if you live your life that way, life is simple. Doing the next right thing every day is really an important model for the firm. It's by doing the next right thing that we've been able to take a U.S.-centric operation and really expand globally. Right now, we have offices in Turkey. So that's a new office that we have. We have an office in Singapore for our Asia Pacific work, where we're decarbonizing both on an avoidance standpoint. So we have technologies in India. We have technologies in China. We're abating super pollutants at scale. We have over 50 million tons a year of reductions under contract in those regions. But we also have nature-based solutions in Indonesia, for instance, where we're working with indigenous women enterprises to restore mangroves on the Indonesian coastline. And we're empowering local communities to do the right thing. And those mangroves are sequestering carbon in Southeast Asia. There's another incredible, great example that we were in Colombia, where we're restoring tropical rainforests. And it made me think about our Colombia project, where, you know, part of climate change is more dramatic weather events. And we had a dramatic weather event in Colombia during our project investment. And the indigenous tribe said, ClimeCo, we can't access the site. The roads got washed out. Can you contribute some additional capital so we could restore the road, so we could go back into our project and replant the tropical rainforest, which has so many additional eco benefits in addition to carbon sequestration, endangered species, local community, employing local indigenous folks. So the first thing we did when we got that message was we invested more capital to restore the road infrastructure so they could get in there and do the planting. So this is where we have a long view in the importance of tying in communities. We also have nature-based projects. Another great example is in Afognak, Alaska, where when we started to work on a project site that actually saved this spiritual timber, this 300-year-old timber in Afognak from being slashed for China timber demand, we worked with the indigenous teams there to implement a project to take 7,000 acres of land, put it in permanent easement with the Rocky Mountain Elk Foundation, and then created hunting rights, created carbon credit value for the indigenous folks. Every time we have a monetization event where we sell the carbon and create a revenue event, we give back to the indigenous folks. We highlight projects that need investments in their communities. That's really an important aspect of what we do, working with indigenous tribes, making sure that the investment is going back to them. They're getting a return from allowing us to preserve their land.
So you're going beyond offsets. ClimbCo is about people and places. It's not just protecting the environment, but it's incorporating communities into the whole ClimbCo ecosystem.
Yeah, absolutely. It's the whole ecosystem, and our ecosystem is our team. You know, when people say, what am I most proud of? It's the impacts that we've made, but it's also the team and the culture that we've harvested, right? We have a culture that is very much based on, we're leaders in our space because we believe in diversity, equity, and inclusion and belonging. And actually our team is the sharpest possible because we have different views from around the world. We have different views from different cultures. We've actually believe it's a competitive advantage of ours. So I think developing this team of honesty and trust and diversity of thought has really differentiated us. So when people say, what are you excited about from an impact standpoint? I'd say climate absolutely first, but the lives of our team and creating family wealth well beyond the ClimbCo years as we promote ownership within ClimbCo with every team member.
That sounds like a powerful testament to ClimbCo's values and mission. I mean, it's clear to me that your commitment to DEI isn't just a philosophy, but a cornerstone of your success. And building a team that embodies honesty, trust, and a rich diversity of perspectives is indeed a competitive advantage in today's world. And your dual focus on environmental impact and creating lasting wealth and opportunity for your team, I think really reflects a holistic approach to sustainability. And it's inspiring to see how ClimbCo is making a difference, both in terms of climate action and in the lives of your team members and those communities close to the ongoing projects.
Yeah, no, Mia, you hit the nail on the head. I love when I first met Bill and his company at one of our workshops. The man has the earth and the interests of the people of the earth before him. And what we're seeing is this new type of capitalism, which responds to the needs of people in different regions of the world, from the mangrove in Indonesia onward. I once had a student from a big family in Indonesia. He studied engineering with me at RPI and is now in the Ministry of Environment type person in Indonesia. So he brought it all back to Indonesia. So you're bringing your insights from climate innovation throughout the world. So what do you do with reluctant clients? How do you motivate them? You're showing them the financial benefits and the carbon solutions. I sometimes used to think of them in my consulting work, Bill, as reluctant dragons. You know, they might be running a multinational and they have this huge tail coming out. And unless I said the right things, they might sway the tail and destroy 100 on their staff. So
yeah, that's such an important question now, even more than ever, right? With a lot of the ESG being focused on, being taken out of the vernacular of companies based on the Washington, D.C. approaches. So now it's more important than ever. But one of our secrets has always been working in what I would call, initially, our focus was to abate nitrous oxide or super pollutants at petrochemical plants. We've abated over 40 million metric tons now. All of those sites are really located in what I would consider more Republican states. So we're a bipartisan company. We work with all sides because we need change now. And how we've done that, Bruce, is we went into facilities and we said, we didn't lead with how you're contributing to climate change or industrial's contribution versus anthropogenic, or we didn't show them pictures of melting icebergs. That wouldn't work. We went in with them with a strategy, which is that you can have a competitive advantage if you reduce your greenhouse gas emissions now. There will be a day when they will be regulated and your competitors will be far behind you. But let's look at using environmental markets to create a positive rate of return for the technologies that we're going to install. We'll invest the capital, or you'll invest the capital, or there will be a hybrid, depending on what you'd like to do. But we're going to show that there's a positive rate of return because we're going to abate your emissions and sell those environmental attributes to data centers, to other companies that want to use those to make a claim. Again, I'm very sensitive on double counting. If we're going to do that project at a petrochemical facility in Kansas, they're not going to take those reductions against their quantifiable goal. They can't, because they sold that right to somebody else.
Because you mentioned double counting. And for those who are not working within companies on sustainability initiatives, there's a lot of skepticism for the average person. They want to support companies that are doing good, but they don't know the accountancy of it. So for those who don't understand, what's the biggest misconception people have about the environmental commodities market and say what you do? And then on that transparency issue, how can companies, you mentioned huge multinationals like Amazon, how can they promote what they do so that the average person can understand and support them without that skepticism?
But I think it's always exciting when you go in and you have a doubter. They know that they have the emissions there. They don't want to spend the capital. They tell you, well, there's no regulation. We don't have to do this. Why would we want to do it? Well, we would come in and say, because it's a competitive advantage. It's a strategy. Act now. Use the markets to pay for the technology. But I would say that's even more important now. And we also work a lot with companies to use their brand, to think differently about perhaps how they go to market. Is there an opportunity for them to decarbonize their product? And having a low carbon intensive product, does that differentiate them in the marketplace? And we can get more into this, but one of our partners is Amazon. And Amazon has proven that under the sustainability platform within Amazon, there is $1 billion of accretive spend there of companies wanting to purchase products that disclose their carbon intensity and have goals to reduce it. That's a big part, Bruce, is I would say reluctant dragons is where we've been living for the last 16 years. Not all of our business. We certainly have a lot of companies that are excited.
Well said. And Mia, that's why he's such a pioneer, that, you know, in the old days when the pioneers used to go from Boston out west.
But you had also mentioned something too, Bruce, about key deputies. And I also look at when we're working with a client, what's our right access point? Is it the environmental manager? Is it the chief sustainability officer? Is it the CEO? Is it the CFO? Oftentimes what we found is that it's certainly not the environmental manager. Oftentimes if we're doing a voluntary project, they don't want to take on anymore. You know, to them, it's just an added work level on their already busy plate. We typically go in is at the CFO level, the CEO level of organizations, and let them know that there can be a positive rate of return for doing the right thing. Once we get them as a stakeholder, they engage the chief sustainability officer, they'll engage the environmental manager. And once their bosses say, once their leaders say, we're doing this, then we get them. So one of our biggest mistakes ever would be going in at too low of a level when we're talking about scalable projects and investment capital and rates of return. We get a deer in the headlight look if we go in at the environmental manager level. So we know where our touch points are within organizations. I would say, you know, within Climco, we have three very specific business units, as well as a really strong marketing and communications team. So, you know, we have a development arm where we're investing our capital, we're developing. And, you know, we picked an amazing leader in Erica Schiller. She came from the energy sector, and she really exudes all of the values of Climco: transparency, honesty, ethics. She's sharp as heck, and she's the leader of our project development team around the globe. Couldn't be more excited about that. I would say it's the key team. If this team left, it would be like one mentor said, it would be like a Mike Tyson punch to the face. Let's make sure that that senior level team is intact, well incentivized, and aligned with our vision. But Erica Schiller would be an example on the project development side. On the sustainability side, we brought in another woman leader who's now our chief growth officer, Emily Damon, who really lifted that practice and built our consulting arm of the firm. And then on the product side, which is where we move all of the reductions that we create through innovative strategies like with Lenovo, which I can talk about as well, that's Derek Six, who was our chief operating officer at that level. On the sales side, we brought in an expert that has a lot of background in communications and sustainability, as well as leading the renewable energy platform for McDonald's. Her name is Emma Cox, and she's just an amazing leader that's taking our communication and our sales strategy to a different level. One of the things you just saw there is three out of my four leaders are women leaders. And, you know, throughout Climco, we actually have, at any given time, more women than men in the company. We're usually 49, 51%. But in leadership positions, we have more women than men within the firm. And it's just a team that we trust. We enjoy being together. Not only that, once a year, even as big as we are, we get our entire staff around the globe together. It's a massive commitment as we grow. And that's for our annual team builder.
Well, that's exciting. As we know, when women come together for a common purpose, they're pretty unstoppable. And it's been the women who are at the forefront of climate action around the world, and they're a collective voice in the fight for a sustainable and just future. I don't want to mention the greenwashing. Unfortunately, there's so many labels and it's hard to understand. We really support those companies that are honestly doing it right. Also then just what mistakes do businesses make when integrating sustainability to their operations to make it clear for everyone involved, consumers and businesses themselves?
Yeah, I mean, that's a really important question. You mentioned a couple items there. One of them is the accounting and the double counting. What's the biggest misconception? And one of the things that I've heard oftentimes is if a company is investing in carbon reductions, it's just a cheap license for them to continue polluting. It's an easy way out. Well, they're buying a carbon credit. It's not really real. It's a cheap license to pollute, right? And if I could look at a project that we've just recently done, we just installed technology in Missouri that's abating, it just went live, 750,000 tons a year of greenhouse gas of CO2 equivalent. That project was done because we had the technology. An oil major came in and they bought 50% of the first 10 years of reductions off that project in prepaid. Prepayment was enough to fund the entire technology for our client. The client themselves, once they made those reductions, they're not counting them towards their own goals. It's the oil major that's transferring that right for the next 10 years, those reductions, that pre-purchase that they made for 50% of the reductions for the next 10 years, they're going to transfer those and retire them against their own obligations. And these are very serialized emission reductions. So when we're creating those emission reductions at a facility, it's through a public registry. It's through a protocol that went through stakeholder comment. So these are really robust. This isn't just Climco creating a protocol saying, this is the base emissions, this is our technology, this is the delta here. Creating a protocol that goes through public stakeholder comment, gets approved by a registry. Once we implement the project, we have a third-party verifier that would come in to verify those reductions. And then the registry takes that verification report. They again review it. So you can imagine that's almost like a three-level review. It's us doing the work and reviewing the quality, submitting it to a verifier. They're reviewing it. It goes to the registry. They're reviewing it. And then once we've made it through all those processes, the registry will serialize those reductions. Every metric ton of reduction has a unique barcode. So it's very tradable. It's very transferable, but it's also very cradle to grave. So if you buy this, Mia, and you hold it in your account, it's still a usable product until you retire it. So once you make a retirement against your own obligation, you're going to make a public statement or you're going to tell your shareholders that you've used carbon as a strategy to reduce your emissions, you're going to retire those serial numbers. And then once they're retired, they can never be used again. And on the registry, they're tracked. So they're tracked who buys it and they're tracked who retires it against their own commitment. So when we talk about double counting, we make sure that one ton, that barcoded one ton can never be sold again because it's retired against somebody's obligation.
Oh, thanks for clarifying that, because I think that that's a story that needs to be told. And one of the biggest misunderstandings is that buying carbon credits or engaging in offset markets is just a way for companies to buy their way out of responsibility rather than making real changes. You know, while some bad actors do exploit these mechanisms, a well-structured carbon market like what you're doing at Climco is essential for funding emission reductions and removals at scale. And many people in the public sphere don't realize that without these markets, projects like reforestation, methane capture, or clean energy in developing countries might not get off the ground. And so I'm just wondering about looking ahead, what trends do you predict will shape the future of carbon markets and environmental commodities? And how do you see your vocation maturing in the future? Because obviously we want to go for a future where we don't have to buy the credits, where it's just everyone reducing their carbon footprint and promoting biodiversity. So how will your business mature in light of a cleaner, greener energy future? Yeah.
Let me talk about that, Mia, but then you had also mentioned greenwashing, because I think in the last several years, there's been a lot of Guardian attacks, Bloomberg attacks. There's been some attacks that are legitimate with companies that don't share our values of ethics and transparency. So some of those were appropriate. But there's also a lot of greenwashing claims that are overly aggressive and not well-founded. So I think one of the areas where we work on with respect to claims, for instance, with Amazon, is that we do have a sustainable badge and a pledge and a protocol that we've approved with Amazon. So if you want to sell your product with a green ClimeCo badge on your product, which digitally goes on everything that works with ClimeCo through the porthole, you know, we're working with Amazon, developed a protocol. Companies will submit their life cycle emissions to us of their product. So imagine a nutritional label for a product. We're getting how much carbon is emitted per unit of production. And that's audited data that we're getting from the supplier. So if you want to participate on this platform, that's the first step, is you need to disclose what your life cycle of emissions are, and they need to be reviewed and audited. And then there needs to be a strategy to reduce those emissions. But over time, what we're able to do to make that claim of carbon compensation is that we retire high quality carbon against those barcodes, those products. And then through our Amazon strategy, they will obtain the badge. But first, they have to show what their life cycle of emissions are. They have to show how they're able to decarbonize within their own supply chain, not just an over-reliance on carbon, but what they can't reduce, they can purchase carbon through ClimeCo and our Amazon platform to surrender that against their own product and earn that badge. So when you're buying that badge, it goes through in-depth protocols. It goes through the compensation of their emissions with high quality carbon, all through a protocol that went through public comment and was approved by Amazon. So we're really sensitive to the greenwashing claims. We want to make sure that those claims are accurate. And it starts with a high quality life cycle. What's the nutritional value of your product? How much carbon is emitted, right?
So Bill, we've now talked about your ability to scientifically and financially verify the carbon reduction claims of key products, not only on Amazon.
Well, it's great that companies like ClimeCo have set the guardrails in place to meet the standards and requirements and set a standard for how sustainability is communicated and implemented. Because the more you can bridge the gap between corporate sustainability actions and consumer understanding, I think the better the entire system will function. Transparency, education, and accountability. Transparency, education, and accountability is critical in ensuring that these efforts aren't dismissed as greenwashing, but rather seen as essential steps toward a sustainable future.
But even in the petrochemical treadmill. And what I reflected on is how, in many ways, this requires a complex team. In many ways, Bill, you're a band leader of some renown, where you have already talked about some of your team players and you select them for their purity of their musicality and their instruments, so that some can be IT, some can be engineering, some can be financial. And just like a Van Morrison will choose the proper guitarist or percussionist, I think you, as the CEO and founder, construct the band. Can you tell us a little bit about how you do that?
I think we have an incredible band, and I love music, and actually we work with a lot of bands. Actually, we have an entertainment focus. We follow our love of music, and we work with bands to have carbon mitigated tours. And we've done this with really popular bands like Pearl Jam. We work with Pearl Jam on making their tour carbon neutral. So it's interesting that you bring up bands, because music is such a key part of our love and our team. In fact, we have a really big initiative in the entertainment space. COVID took an entertainment hit. Once bands quit touring, that took a hit on us, but now it's alive and well again. So one of the neat journeys that we've had at ClimeCo as we're working with bands, when we started to work with Pearl Jam, we started to work not just with their PR reps, but it was with Stone Gossard himself, you know, the guitarist, Eddie's partner over all those years. And being a Pearl Jam fan, it was like, oh my God, you know, Stone Gossard's calling. And as we started to work with Stone, it was obvious that as an environmentalist, he was so passionate about what types of projects they invested in to offset their European tour that he wanted to visit the forests. He wanted to go to the projects. His level of due diligence was greater than most of our industrial due diligence. So it was really fun working with him. Our only disappointment at the end was that I had sent Stone a note and I said, you know, Dan, who's your point of contact within Climbco, he's a guitar player. It would be really special for him if he could play a song with you on guitar in the forest, you know, actually, you know, jam guitar with you. And Stone was, you know, very polite and said, well, I get a little nervous. I don't like to do this typically out at an event like this, but if we play one of our core songs, like I'll play guitar with Dan. So my wife and I bought Dan an amazing acoustic guitar because Dan didn't have an acoustic like this. And we were at a Rotary auction as a Rotarian. It was a silent auction. My wife and I bid on a great acoustic guitar. All the money went to help international projects around the globe through Rotary International. And we took that guitar with us. And the whole story was going to be that Stone was going to meet us in the forest and Dan was going to play guitar with Stone and Stone was going to sign Dan's guitar that we just bought him. Unfortunately, the night before, Stone Gossard's wife just had a baby and he texted us the next day the photo of his daughter. We were probably one of the first ones that saw the photo. And he said to us the night before, sorry, I'm not going to be able to hike in the forest with you, which was sad because my wife and I came out. We wanted to meet Stone in person and have him hike the forest with us and have Dan on our team actually play acoustic to one of the early Pearl Jam songs off the album 10. So unfortunately, that didn't happen. But I got to say, working with bands like that and following their passion, we've also worked with Third Eye Blind. We've been on stage with Third Eye Blind and Stephen Jenkins to talk about how sustainability means a lot to that band. So it's really cool working with artists and realizing that artists are just incredibly passionate about the environment, so many of them, and just trying to leverage and learn from them has been a ton of fun for us.
Beautiful story.
That's really beautiful. And I can put you in touch with Rick Bass as well, who's a writer, but he has a thing included musicians called Voice of the Forest. And as a writer, as an environmentalist, he's actually a geologist originally, and he witnessed these clearings of ancient forests. So he got this idea to do this event that included well-known musicians. So they were going to like clear 1,000-year-old trees. And it's just so sad. So he got a section of wood and he just had a vision that he wanted to do a musical event. And he took this ancient piece of wood and then he delivered it to this musician maker to make a guitar from it. So it's like a symbol, the voice of the forest. How could a song inspire a movement?
Love it. Love it. Cool.
It's beautiful. And it's interesting to think about how the forest can contain, how a piece of wood, it's a different sound, you know, that ancient wood sound.
Yeah.
It's all those years. It is that carbon, but it's all those years. It's that life compressed into the wood.
In the experiences of the wood, we host cellists in our home here up in Lake Placid when we're here for the Sinfonietta. So we open up our home and allow members of the orchestra to stay with us. And I learned a lot from a cellist friend of ours that I met that played with in front of Yo-Yo Ma and just an incredible individual. But just the age of the cello. And as it ages, it matures. And who plays it matters because the wood takes on the music and the life of the previous owners. So, you know, I found out so much about instruments like the cello and really how valuable they are. And there's actually people who invest, like equity investors in a cello. But then the cello is donated to individuals like Andre, who stays with us because he can't afford these cellos. They're very expensive. But they want him to play it to further mature the instrument.
Interesting.
And I love music and it's an interesting analogy and I never thought of it that way, Bruce. That's why I love talking to you. You look at things through your lens and we put a great band together. Right now we're around 100 people globally. And at my age, I'm probably within the top 5%. We have a great mix. That's the diversity of thought, right? When we bring folks out of college, yeah, one of the things I say immediately to them is that we hope to learn as much from you as you'll learn from us. So don't think that you're just with folks that they're more senior. You know, you're not going to share maybe innovative thoughts on ways we could do things differently. We really promote the fresh out of school, very in-depth mentoring program within the firm. So I've been a mentor for the last three sessions. So we always take folks that have that high potential and we believe that A's hire as an organization. We're very cautious on B's because B's tend to hire C's. Why? Because they're threatened. A's aren't threatened. We don't mind making that we're mentoring somebody that can take our jobs because we can move on to something else. I think bringing in Erica's level or Emily's level or Emma's level, who brings decade plus of experience in the market, are also really important. So I think it's the diversity of age. It's the diversity of universities. It's the geographical diversity. You know, it's everything that makes us special. And I'm really proud of that. One of the areas, Mia, you had also mentioned trends. Let me talk about that. I mean, to talk a little bit about where we see some of the trends moving. Because where I get excited about trends, and Bruce had mentioned a couple times Lenovo. And I want to talk a little bit about Lenovo because they're a trendsetter. But one of the areas where we're seeing the market go to is what we call insetting instead of offsetting. So if we're creating a reduction at a plan and we're selling that reduction as an offset, their product's life cycle does not change. Their life cycle of emissions do not change because they sold that right to somebody else. We're seeing a transition where if we can embed that reduction with the product, for instance, in the cement sector, where we decarbonize cement. Currently, we sell the carbon reduction separately, which is an offset or a derivative. Think about taking the reductions from the product and selling it separately as a derivative to somebody that's buying it to make a claim. The cement then is sold as conventional cement, gray cement. It doesn't have any environmental attributes because those are sold. What we believe the change is that we want to embed those reductions and sell it with the cement or sell it with the product, embed it. That's that nutritional label aspect, me and Bruce, that we spoke about. Imagine seeing that, yes, we've made the reduction and what you're buying is a low carbon product that you can use towards your scope 3 emission reduction goals. And let me highlight what scope 3 is. So the science-based target, which is a big initiative that 5,000 plus companies around the globe have signed up for, you know, they in the World Resource Institute as well, in the Greenhouse Gas Protocol, there's vernacular in our industry that scope 1, which is your emissions at your facility, what you're directly emitting to the atmosphere. You know, you've got exhaust stacks, you're emitting carbon dioxide. Scope 2, which is your electricity consumption, that's your grid. So there's an emission factor associated with your electricity based on where you're located. And then scope 3, which is your supply chain. So what are you buying? What's their carbon intensity? So as the scope 3 targets with science-based targets have really accelerated, companies are looking at ways to decarbonize their scope 3. So the trend that we're seeing, and the reason why we took one of our top performers, because we believe in taking your top performers to your biggest opportunity, not your biggest threat. We took Emily, who led our sustainability practice, and now she's our chief growth officer, looking at this trend of embedding the reductions with the product now, getting away from an offset. 10 years from now, offsets may not exist because the world may be focused on and willing to pay for that green premium of a low carbon product. But until they're willing to pay for that, we have to use the offset market, because there are other buyers that are willing to pay a premium. So we have to be able to create that as a derivative and sell it separately. But I believe there's going to be a day where we're embedding everything with the product. You're getting a digital carbon nutritional label with the product. And as you're thinking about your sourcing or your supply chain, you're buying products that have a lower carbon intensity, and you're using that towards your scope 3 reduction goal. That's a major driver right now that we're focused on.
That's ideally the holistic. It's not detaching it, like denaturizing it. It's all embedded. And I really like that as a way forward. Now, you've spoken about areas around the world, Colombia, Indonesia. These are all different cultures as well. And they have different relationships to the land. Of course, the land is an integral part of any environmental movement since the beginning of the conservation movements. And when you're dealing with these different cultures, I just wonder what your approach is and how you adapt that to, say, even in the narrative and different indigenous cultures where it's a philosophy of not of ownership, but of, you know, collective sharing, a collective cooperative. If you see the rise of movements like Dalai's Earth Law, it's a different conception of thinking. I mean, buying and selling credits as opposed to something that you can never own. They're two diverging philosophies. So how do you come to speak the same language and do that important work around land rights? I had just read that 40% of land in America is public. So how can we work around that and also respect the people who, the original inhabitants and their cultures?
Well, I'll break it down into two different areas, because a lot of what we're doing in a lot of these countries isn't necessarily land-based. It can be technology-based, but I do believe in cultural sensitivities. Like, for instance, when we went to India, we have a lot of folks on our team from India. I remember having our teammates give an India cultural sensitivity discussion in a presentation about what's important for that culture. The same thing with China, the same thing with every country that we go into. So we try to leverage our team to make sure that we're understanding how the culture may negotiate differently, on how they value relationships differently, on what's appropriate. So I think we're always very sensitive to wherever we go in. And to Bruce's point, that also applies to the U.S. if we're in a certain state or if we're in Canada in a certain province. So I think always understanding where we're working and respecting the culture is important. With respect to your land right question, I would say that I'll give you a couple examples. Even in Louisiana, all the work that we do is state land. So it's owned by the state and it's managed by Louisiana Department of Wildlife and Fisheries. So we create a partnership with the Louisiana Department of Wildlife and Fisheries where we're the investor doing all the planting on their coastline. It's bringing a lot of value to the local community there from a fishing aspect, from a hurricane resilience aspect. It was Hurricane Katrina that wiped out a lot of the bald cypress, but also over-harvesting of the bald cypress wood caused this as well. So from a hurricane resilience, it's a big issue. But when we partner with a state agency like that, we're the investor. One of our investment is to make sure that they have the right vehicles to access the land because this is marshy acreage along the coastline. But then once it's planted, they're responsible for overseeing it. So that's a partnership, right? We're the investor, we're the planter, they're the manager of the property afterwards. It's a real symbiotic relationship is that we're giving to them, they're giving to us. If I go back to my Alaska example, when we bought that project wasn't giving a recurring revenue to the indigenous tribes, the Afognak Native Corporation. So it was a great project when we bought into it, because it preserved land, that was a benefit. But when you're thinking like the indigenous tribes are, they're getting a dividend check from that land. So the reason why a lot of those indigenous tribes sold the timber rights is because it meant revenue to them. It may not have been the right thing for the stewardship of the land, but if you get a dividend off the land and you're a tribesman or tribeswoman, an indigenous population, that revenue means everything to you. So how you make a difference like that is you show the indigenous folks that you're going to give up on the timber revenue, but there's a carbon revenue to preserve that land. Or there's hunting licenses because we work with the Rocky Mountain Elk Foundation to preserve as a revenue base. There's other alternative revenue. You don't need to sell it for timber harvesting. So it's going in and working with local communities, but it's also saying, what's important to you? So with a Native Corporation, one of the things that was important to them is that they had a program called I Dig Afognak. It was a way to educate youngsters, young folks, about the history of Afognak Native Corporation. It was a camping site, an educational facility where they would go in and they would actually dig for historical Native memorabilia, and they would learn about the indigenous community. Well, when they came to us and they said, Bill, we would really like, it's undernourished. We don't have the capital to maintain I Dig Afognak, the community, the educational center. And they said, that would be one of the projects we would love to see further investment in. And then another area that they told us they need further investment in is one of their local ports to get more the hunters and fishers in. It needed infrastructure improvements. So we let them choose the projects that were important to them. And then once we bought that project, the difference between Climco and the previous owner is we said that every time we have a monetization event, we're going to give back to the Afognak Native Corporation. Those are the two projects. We didn't believe that we should identify the projects. Why would we have the right to identify the projects? They know what's most important for their communities. So I think it's just, you know, giving back to the communities is really important. In Indonesia, again, we don't own the land. That's state-owned. Those are country-owned land. But where we make a difference is not going in and thinking that we know the community well. It's working with women-owned enterprises and indigenous folks to hire them to do all the planting and to create livelihoods for them. So again, it's just giving back. None of the land projects work unless you give back to local societies. And whether or not it's in the states, like we've done with Louisiana Department of Wildlife and Fisheries, or Alaska, or other countries like Indonesia and Colombia are great examples.
So Bill, and just with all these projects, I'm just wondering what awakened your desire to be like a steward for this planet? I mean, what were you like as a boy, you know, as a young man, you know, what awakened this spirit of protection and affection for Earth?
Well, I it's a great question. And, you know, I'm a meteorologist before I got a business degree. So I always enjoyed being out in nature and just understanding how the globe works, right? My wake-up call was after 16 years of being an environmental consultant, working with industry as they installed new operations to make sure that they had permits to install, but we also studied the air quality impacts associated with emissions from their facilities, air dispersion modeling, all kind of consultancy work. I did that for 16 years. And then during the Bush administration, the Kyoto Protocol was being discussed, this first global pact. And the U.S. didn't ratify that protocol. So, you know, the U.S. wasn't a participant of that early Kyoto Protocol. We were a bystander. And that was one of my wake-up calls, Mia, was, you know, we're not putting a price on that externality of greenhouse gases. We're regulating with the Clean Air Act, which is an amazing document, an amazing regulation that was founded during the Republican regime. It was, you know, that's a Clean Water Act, Clean Air Act. These are foundational to the U.S., but they don't regulate greenhouse gases. So when the U.S. stepped aside from the Kyoto Accord, I thought to myself, we're really missing something. If you don't put a price on an externality, it doesn't create a behavior shift, right? If you can dump greenhouse gases out into the atmosphere and not have it regulated, who's going to care about it? Why would you pay attention to it? It may be a competitive disadvantage if you're paying attention to it and others aren't. So I think that was the awakening when the Bush administration didn't ratify that. And then in 2007, I had left a cozy 16-year career to go work for a global leader in climate change, focused on the Kyoto implementation, focused on reducing carbon in developing countries and transferring that right to developed countries in Western Europe, as an example. So that was kind of my epiphany. And then soon after that, I thought to myself, this is a great mechanism. Why don't we bring this to the United States? Why don't we bring this from a voluntary standpoint to the United States? Because I believe that we can identify technologies and strategies. We can work with registries, but we can use the capital markets now. So if you're not putting a price on carbon, let us put a price on carbon. As a market maker, I'm going to tell you that I believe we can reduce your emissions. And on a per ton basis, I believe this is what we can sell it for. So I started to put a price on that externality using market-based solutions. And that's really how we started to implement and create Climco. But I think it's my love for the environment. I live in Lake Placid half of the year, Houston the other. I come up here to enjoy the nature, to climb all 46 peaks, a 46er. My wife and I spend a lot of time in the mountains. I'm a private pilot. I enjoy being up in the sky. I enjoy taking care of our environment. And that's a big passion of mine, Mia. Bruce, I would say my toughest decision that I made when I leaped into being, I'm not a serial entrepreneur. I've not done this before. This is my first rodeo. So when I launched after 16 years of having a consistent paycheck, just, you know, the comfort of having a 16-year career at one organization, I could have stayed there forever. But it was that step into the unknown. And I'd say the journey or the path isn't always what you think it's going to be. I took that step with two other individuals and I created Climco. There was three founders. I had bought them out later in 2012 and took 100% ownership at that time. Being surrounded by these two other individuals gave me a little more comfort. It wasn't just me. It was me and two partners. The partnership didn't work exactly like I had hoped, but because of the partnership, I felt comfortable to take that first step. My next big step and my next biggest decision, and it's because of my life partner, Linda, that Climco exists today. It was about 3 years in, you know, we were really close to making it, but we spent everything, spent the savings. I depleted my 401k. I rolled everything into this. I sold my house. I moved into a commercial property I owned because I could live in one of the apartments that I wasn't renting. I really tucked in my wings because I spent everything to make this happen. One of the companies I was working with at the time said, it was a big trading company, one of the largest trading companies in the world, said, I like what you're doing. Why don't you collapse Climco and come work for us? And I got to tell you, as being the feeling like I need to be the provider of my household and having my wife go back to work as a social worker so we could put food on the table, it was really tempting. And I remember going to Linda and saying, what should we do? This is more money than I could ever have asked for. Should I leave Climco and take this position? And she said to me, well, let's talk about it. Like, how close are you? I mean, do you think that you're going to be successful? And I said, you know, we've got like this one contract. It's just about ready to sign. This is going to be really the springboard for Climco. I've been working on this one for a long time. And she said, Bill, trust it. How can you ever go work for a big entity? You've got something here. Trust yourself. Tell them no. And the next day I had breakfast with this individual and I said, thank you very much, but I'm not going to accept your offer. I'm going to continue to move forward with Climco. And then this individual, who's still a great friend of mine today, said, if you can't join us, how can we make you successful? We want to be surrounded. What a great thing, right, Bruce? So You know, it was like, yeah, and we've taken that forward. That concept of how can we help you? Well, they did. I said, well, how can you help us? Well, our first project is once we sign it, we're going to create almost 1 million tons of reductions a year. Could you prepay us for some of those reductions? Could you be the bank that we need because the banks don't trust us? And they said, absolutely. We believe in you. We will do that. So it was that relationship that meant so much. Moving forward, I tell our team all the time that, you know, how can we make other people successful? One of the most incredible acquisitions that I made on a forestry side was with a great forestry company out of Vancouver that didn't want to sell the company originally, but I knew that they were struggling from a cash flow perspective. And I said, well, since you're working for us, how can I help you? Can I give you an upfront payment retainer that you can draw upon to make your cash flow concerns? Can I alleviate those for you? How can we be a trusted partner? How can I make you successful? Because if you're successful, I believe we're going to be successful. And then ultimately, we acquired that company a couple of years later because they saw who we are as a firm, how we act, right? So Bruce, that lesson, that toughest decision, I move that forward and I use that as a life lesson within our organization as well.
That's so important. Again, it's not about ownership. It's about partnership always.
In many ways, Bill, you're a band leader of some renown where you have already talked about some of your team players, and you select them for their purity of their musicality and their instruments, so that some can be IT, some can be engineering, some can be financial. And just like a Van Morrison will choose the proper guitarist or percussionist, I think you, as the CEO and founder, construct the band. Can you tell us a little bit about how you do that?
So thank you, Bill Federbach and ClimbCo, for championing transparency of climate innovation and just for all you do to empower entrepreneurship and provide pathways to a greener and cleaner energy future. Thank you for making a difference each day. We all live on one planet we call home. Thank you for adding your voice to Business and Society and One Planet podcast.
Thank you, Mia. And thank you, Bruce.
Yes. Thank you, Bill. Mia and I really enjoyed having you on the show today.
This interview was conducted by Bruce Piasecki and Mia Funk. Associate interviews producer on this podcast was Andrew Green. Digital media coordinator was Julia Rhodes. Theme music is written and performed by Juan Sanchez. We hope you enjoyed this episode.